Okay, so I had a planned layover in Michigan. I was supposed to meet some of my family, but there was drama happening, and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I'm driving down the road, and my hands, unbidden, turn the wheel of the rental car away from all that and start taking me in a new direction, a whole other highway. I'm wondering where we're going, but when I feel myself relaxing, I think maybe my hands know what they're doing. I'm riding up to farm country outside of Marlette, Michigan, where I lived as a boy. And again, that seems like a very good idea. It's kind of end of the summer, beautiful outside. I haven't seen anybody up there in years, way past time. And if I'm really lucky, I'll catch our former neighbors, the Page family, around lunchtime. I used to practically live at their house. It occurs to me to call ahead. Hell no, I'm not calling ahead. I'm showing up. The more I drive, the more familiar it is. I remember this place. I remember that farm. They used to have a yellow barn. Yellow barn. There used to be a pasture over where that trailer is. The closer I get, the bigger my smile. I fell out of that tree, that one right there. Bust my head wide open. Fine. The few family farms left still go by the old ways, which means everyone working eats lunch and dinner. I mean, lunch and supper. They eat together, prepared by the missus. I pull up, and the smell. I know exactly what Miss Page cooked, because I used to eat that very same blackberry cobbler as a boy. I haven't seen these people in well over a decade, but I don't knock. I walk in through the kitchen, see everybody sitting around the dining room table, and just ask if they mind if I have a little something to eat. Papa Page doesn't blink.
It's big city. Big city, come back out to the farm.
I stop Miss Page from piling my plate long enough to get a hug, get a what's up chest bump from the sons. They introduce me to some of the farmhands. Charlie, Juan, Hector. We get basic greetings out the way, but I hear the farm clock ticking. I realize I've cost them a few minutes. Papa Page is like,
"You're staying here tonight, of course. Me and the boys, we're gonna finish baling out hay. We'll catch up after supper. See you in a few hours, city."
All the fellas start getting up, heading towards the barn. I'm like, whoa, what you talking about? I'm here to work.
City, you don't know from working out here.
Shh. I'm not even trying to hear this noise. Rule number one, you do not just sit around on a farm. It's not done.
You understand. We're baling hay, right?
Now my dander's up. They think I'm some lost suburbanite who doesn't know which end of a barn door to open. You think I forgot how to bale hay?
And that takes us to rule number two on the farm. Don't just keep talking once a decision's made.
You'll never ever meet a chatty farmer. There is no such thing.
So we go out to the barn. There's a huge load of hay bales and a conveyor. Once the bale of hay pops off the conveyor, you pass it hand to hand to hand until someone stacks it. It's heavy, hard, manly work. It's been a long time. I can't wait. I take my place in line. I'm ready, Jack.
It takes me 30, maybe 40 seconds to realize why everyone's looking at me curious. I've made the biggest rookie mistake there is. The biggest. I'm wearing a t-shirt and shorts. There's a reason everyone's wearing thick jeans and long shirts on one of the hottest days of the year. When you're tossing hay bales from one person to the other, they cut as if they're made of broken glass. And we gotta empty three entire truckloads.
stack them in the barn. I've talked a big game, a huge game. Which brings us to rule number 3. Don't say jack to farmers that you can't back up. So we go, and we go, and we go until every truck sits empty. And I'm broken, barely able to walk. But I walk toward the house. I ask Miss Page if I can please clean up before supper. The shower stings hot. I look down at the water, red with blood and pride and stupidity. Now I put on my jeans. Now I find a long sleeve shirt. I sit down at the table. I hurt too much to smile. I look too pitiful for them not to.
Looks like we should have found some paperwork for you to do, Big City.
Paperwork. I strain to stab potatoes onto my fork and lift my hand towards my mouth. It hurts, it hurts, it hurts, it hurts. Even as I struggle, even as they laugh, I know that this is a way better layover than the one I had planned. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, layover. Amazing stories of all the things that can happen between point A and point B. My name is Glenn Washington. Please set your tray table to the upright position, because this here is Snap Judgment. You've heard people say that it's not the getting there that matters, it's the journey. Well, today, instead of waving away the hows and whys of how someone got from here to there, we're digging deep. And Jason was on an around-the-world trip, powered by his own body. He was paddling, he was rollerblading, he was circumnavigating the globe, using only human power, and it took him 7 years to get from London to Hawaii. On the way, he tangled with pirates in the Caribbean, almost drowned in the Atlantic, and now he decided to head for a teeny tiny island in the Pacific, Tarawa. But apparently, between Hawaii and Tarawa, there's a stretch of ocean, there's a patch where the water actually flows backwards. It's called the countercurrent.
There are stories of sailors, of course, going insane, going mad, because you don't know when you're going to get out.
Sailors nicknamed it the horse latitudes. Their huge ships with their lifeless sails could be caught for months on end. Out of desperation, the crew would throw their horses overboard, hoping to lighten the load.
This is the dilemma that the sailing ships had in the golden age of sail. They would get stuck in the countercurrent for days, weeks, months. And there's very little wind, so the water is flat calm. It's a very sort of static environment.
Jason would be sailing a small ship he called Moksha. It didn't have any sails or a motor, only a bike crank that he pedaled. Moksha was just a little wider than a bathtub, with barely any room to stand. There's a place to sleep, a place to pedal, and a place to stash limited amounts of food and water. And that's it. You can walk the whole boat in about 26 steps. He had to pedal all day if he wanted to get anywhere in a normal current, and if he ran into the counter current, there was no way of pedaling out. If he hit the countercurrent, Jason's only hope would be to find something called a back eddy.
Occasionally, you will get these little wormholes in the currents.
The back eddy would allow him to break out of the countercurrent, but stumbling on one would be sheer luck. With that in mind, Jason loaded up his boat with as many supplies as he could fit, and he shoved off.
I then pedaled out of Kona on the west side of Hawaii, and there was this definite sense of stepping into the void, of stepping into a state of not knowing.
All Jason had with him was some food, water, and a GPS that he used to keep track of his progress. Every morning, he checked his coordinates and then marked his location on his map to make sure that he was on track to Tarawa. He ate, he paddled, he slept, and he checked his map. Everything was routine for about a month. Then, on the 46th day...
I remember waking up and standing in the hatch with a cup of tea, and there was no wind, absolute silence. And I thought, wow, this is going to be an easy bit of water to pedal across today. I switched on the GPS, and I thought there's something odd about the figures, because the figures were pretty much the figures that I'd written down the previous morning. And the dot that I wrote down on the chart was on the same position that I'd written down the previous morning. And I thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with the GPS. So I rebooted the GPS. And I suddenly realized that while I was sleeping, the boat had actually been going backwards in the countercurrent. And I thought, well, you know, at this point, I could be in here an hour. I could be in this countercurrent for, I don't know, a day.
Jason jumped in the cockpit and pedaled straight through the day. He skipped breaks. He ate fast.
And after a day of pedaling on the spot, I was absolutely bored out of my mind and starting to get a bit panicky. And the second morning, I remember waking up and pretty tired, switching on the GPS, and I was back where I had been the previous morning. And it just got progressively worse as the days progressed.
This is what Jason did every single day. And every day he was in the exact same spot. Any ground he had gained the day before, he lost while he slept.
And when I entered the countercurrent, it was just blissful. And it's beautiful. I mean, the water is clear, so you can see straight down for hundreds and hundreds of feet. But then after a few days, this sort of flat calm, this totally static environment started to sort of work on my nerves after a while and work on my brain, because you can't really tell the difference between where the water ends and the sky begins. I sort of lost a sense of place, a sense of kind of cosmic fix as to where I was in the world. After 2 weeks, I was running out of things to sort of keep my spirits up. I could not pedal anymore. I had reached the end of my rope, mentally, physically, and emotionally, and I lay down on the bottom of the boat, and I curled up in a ball, and I cried. And it was, without doubt, the most demoralizing point in the entire 13-year circumnavigation. But as I was lying there, crying, and having a meltdown, it occurred to me that actually the boat was going backwards, and that as long as it was going backwards in the countercurrent, there was a greater chance of the food running out and the water running out, and there was a greater chance of the voyage failing. After I had my mini breakdown, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to find a way to keep pedaling. As long as I could keep pedaling, there was just a chance that I would find one of these little wormholes between the different bodies of water, and maybe one day I would eventually get out of this countercurrent. It was the next morning, and I was just finished my breakfast. I was washing the pan over the side, the saucepan over the side, and there were lots of fish that would congregate underneath the boat, these little black and white striped pilot fish. And one of these fish they would come out and feed on the food scraps. One of these fishes I'd nicknamed Homer after Homer Simpson, because it was like the fattest, it was the greediest. And I started talking to this fish to say, "Oh, come on, you know, Holmes, here's your porridge. You know, you'll get any fatter than you are already, and you'll be feeding the 5,000 sort of thing."
At first, Jason was just talking to a fish, but as the days passed, he soon had an entire cast of companions to talk to, even though he was completely alone.
This voice, in this broad Northern Irish voice from Belfast, said to me, "You got to leave that little guy alone, you know. Pick on someone your own size." And then we were joined by this German former U-boat commander, this old German sea captain. "What are you doing? You don't have any experience of the sea like the German U-boat commander." I had one more that became part of this medley of personalities, this Frenchman from the Monty Python series. "You ridiculous English fool, your mother was a hamster and your father smelled of elderberry." It was more like a comedy show going on in my head than anything.
Jason knew he was talking to himself, but at some point he stopped being able to turn it off.
I was just having a bit of fun. But then after a while, because basically I was so lonely and these guys became my friends, they did take on more of an external reality, if you like. All of these guys were very, very insulting to me. And we would have these ferocious arguments. You know, the pedal system broke at one point, and I'm just fixing the pedal unit, and these guys are just keeping me company. They're just arguing about the best way to do it, like guys do, right? Guys always argue about the best way to do things.
"You don't know how to do the mechanics, you know. You take off the propeller first,
your propeller shaft's broken here,
and then you unscrew the propeller shaft.
This is, yeah,
you shut up, you ridiculous English fool. What are you doing? Are you going insane?
Guys, this is my boat. I'm in charge here." Because there was no one else out there to tell me otherwise, it seemed to me just a completely natural way of dealing with this very, very extreme situation.
And when they did become a little bit more nagging and a little bit more serious, and the arguments became a little bit more heated about what we were going to have for dinner that night, there wasn't any awareness on my part of it suddenly going to a different level.
Then finally, on the 17th day in the countercurrent,
I'd started my day normally. I had my three characters who were keeping me company there in every little decision, how to make lunch, just small little things always. And then I stood up in the hatch. The ocean was like glass as usual. And I felt this breath of air hit my cheek from the south. And then I thought, this is strange because it's not dying down like it normally does. And it was just a steady flow of air, and it strengthened to this breeze. And I knew that this was wind. This was real wind.
These were the southeast trade winds. This meant he was finally out of the countercurrent.
And I just got back on the pedals again and just started cranking away.
Jason paddled for 11 more days. And after over 2 months at sea, Jason finally spotted the black ribbon of Tararua on the horizon.
I had been out there on this ocean for 73 days by this point. I'd gone a little bit crazy. And land means life.
It occurred to me that I couldn't arrive babbling in these different tongues. I couldn't arrive as Serge the Frenchman or Heinz the crazy U-boat commander or the IRA terrorist. So I had this reality check. And so it actually took a pretty conscious decision on my part to, okay, guys, you have to go now. You have to leave now. And they put up a little bit of resistance. The Irishman was like, bollocks, you know, we're not going anywhere. Why don't you leave yourself? And then they were gone. And I was pedaling away in the very bright sunlight, just repeating like a mantra, like cold beer, cold beer, cold beer, cold, in time with my pedal rotations. Finally, the boat nudged up against the pier, and I stood up, found myself surrounded by this amphitheater of fishermen. They're like, "Where's the motor?" "Oh, no motor." "Where's the sail?" "No sail."
And then I showed them the pedal mechanism. And they're like, oh my God. And then he started talking and jabbering. And just the sound of people's voices was almost overbearing. And then having to deal with conversation with other people again, not just with myself. And part of this also was this sort of sneaking guilt, I guess, in the back of my mind that I had gone a little bit crazy out there.
We live our lives, our regular lives, in a quite a sort of rigid framework in terms of not only where we live, but also social ties to our friends and our family. And once you take yourself out of that rigid structure and place yourself in a very sort of alien environment where you don't have any of those reference points, then it's quite disconcerting after a while. Okay, I've done this solo voyage and I thought it was going to be this whole Zen-like experience of pedaling off into the mystic, but that didn't happen, and I got stuck in the countercurrent and I went a bit doolally instead. I went a bit crazy.
It's funny, it's amusing, but it's also a bit sort of sad. I just realised how incredibly lonely I was.
Thank you, Jason. Now, if you want to read more about Jason's 13-year circumnavigation of the globe, check out his book, The Expedition Dark Waters. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Jasmine DaCosta with assistance from Julia DeWitt. Now, when we return, somebody's going to do hard time, and somebody's going to get dissed. Hard. In Snap Judgment, the layover episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Snap. Today we're exploring what happens on the way from here to there. And there are moments in your life when you get the kind of news that changes everything. And that's where this next story starts. Gary Hayward was broke, fresh out of the military, living with his moms, when he got a letter inviting him to start training as a correction officer in the New York City penal system.
Hello, my name is Gary Hayward, and I was born and raised in Harlem, New York City, in the infamous Polo Ground Projects, 155th Street and 8th Avenue. Since I came home from the military, the only job that I could find was security. So this particular day, I came home, and my mother handed me a letter that was from the Department of Corrections that said that I was going to start working. It was like winning the lotto. It's hard to get city and state jobs. So when I got the letter, it was like hitting the jackpot. We were just so happy. Me and my mother started dancing around the living room. We was doing the roach stomper, you know, because we had a lot of practice. He broke down and did the Watusi. But it was just a happy occasion. In a sense, it meant that I could better my life and possibly move out the neighborhood, get a better surrounding for my kids and myself. Where I'm from, police are everywhere. First, for the job, they do an extensive background check. It was unusual because I never so much got a ticket for illegal turnstile, open container, anything. I never got in trouble with the law at all. My first day was terrifying when I first stepped inside that jail and that door closed behind me. I was scared to death, STD, scared to death. I'm sitting there faced with individuals. Sometimes you hear, oh, this guy committed murder, or this guy is a drug kingpin. So you kind of like looked at all of them the same way, like whatever you did, that was your choice. You know, you make your bed, you lay in it. Well, I had been on the job about 3 or 4 months, and then I heard somebody say, hey, G. if somebody says G or Gary, 9 times out of 10 is someone who knows me from out in the street. So when I heard, hey, G, the first thing that came to mind is, this is somebody who knows me from the street. And when I turned around, it was my friend Biz, who I had grew up with. So it was kind of like, holy snap, how do I handle this? I knew this was going to happen, but I didn't expect it to happen this soon. My first instinct is protect your job. Do what you got to do to protect your job. So I snapped at him and I told him, my name is Officer Haywood while I'm in here and you address me as such. He stepped back in shock because this is my childhood buddy where, you know, when our families didn't have food, we loaned each other food. His mother took care of me, my mother took care of him. We shared clothes and sneakers, and I know it was a shock to him, for me, of all people, to tell him, call me Officer Haywood while you're in here. I felt like a sellout pretty much, but then I felt like I was doing what I had to do for my job. The rule is, if I run into somebody I know, I write a letter to my command and let them know, and they're supposed to move that person out of your jurisdiction, out of your jail, so that you won't show favoritism or you won't be put in a compromised position. Well, officers judge. Officers are real judgmental. So if you get to writing 5 or 10 letters, every time they look around, they get a letter from you, because if he knows all these criminals, then he may either have dabbled in crime, or eventually he will commit a crime. I didn't want to be judged. I didn't follow that rule. And Biz was the type of guy who used jail like a revolving door. He was constantly in and out of jail, stressing his mother out. It was a little while later where I was sitting in the break room like most officers do, and an alarm goes off and it rings real loud. It's called the 1013. 1013 means immediate response. That means stop what you're doing and respond to the area. Me and a couple of other officers, we're running to respond to the area. And as we approach, we see a female struggling with an inmate. And she has his hoodie pulled over his head. We also noticed that her nose was busted. So that, you don't hit women, number one. You don't hit officers. So this inmate did a double no-no by hitting a female officer and busting her nose. I was the first one to arrive there, and I just went ballistic. I went ballistic, punching and hitting them and kicking them and punching them down. For about a good minute or two, we just proceeded to really go in on this guy. And then all of a sudden, his hoodie came off, and I realized that it was my friend Biggs. Shock went through my body and I didn't know what to do. And when I fell back, his eyes locked on my eyes. Everything just came up, like the childhood, and just like a quick flash, it was like, what did I just do? He kind of just blocked everybody else out and just looked at me, and I looked at him. And the other people around was too busy just, you know, hitting on him to realize the connection between me and him. It was crazy. My heart sunk. I couldn't speak. My mouth got dry. I didn't know what to say if I did want to speak. I know I wanted them to stop, but at the same time, I didn't want to be crucified for stopping officers for beating on the inmate. We're supposed to be family, meaning me and the officers. My body shut down and I didn't react. I didn't say nothing and I didn't do nothing and I didn't stop anybody. I just sat there and I watched and just felt really bad about the whole thing. You gotta understand that they drill in your head that inmates are the enemy. Once you become an inmate, he's an inmate. Don't worry about him. He's an inmate. He's nothing. He's low. And you treat him this way. It's not so much that, okay, I could do wrong to this person and get away with it. It's just that this is the way it is. This is the way the job is. You're not supposed to be treated good in prison. You're not supposed to want to come back to prison because it's not a hotel. We control your every move, everything you do, when you eat, when you sleep, everything. So an inmate came up to me and asked me, could he get some toilet paper? And I told him, go wipe your behind with your hand, because I just didn't want to be bothered. He knew it was wrong for me to say that to him, but I didn't care because in here, I had godlike powers, and what are you going to do? Write your congressman. But also, people don't realize that correction, we're human. We go through the same drama as everyday life. In my instance, I was going through divorce with the child support. I was really going through it with my pay. After child support, my check was about $39. I lost my car. My car got repossessed. My apartment, I had to move back in with my mother. My life was spiraling downwards. So now my back is against the wall. Now I'm sitting here wondering what I'm going to do, how I'm going to survive. And I knew this particular inmate from the street, and I knew that his family had money. And I knew that if I brung him in something, because he'd been asking me anyway, that I could make money. So the next time he asked me, I gave into it. I made arrangements, and then that's how I started bringing contraband inside the jail. At the time, they had something called Tops Tobacco that cost me $2 to purchase from a store. And then the inmate would give me $300 for a $2 pouch of tobacco. The first time I brought contraband inside the jail, I felt like I could hear my heartbeat over everything. I felt that everyone was watching me. That particular day, I took my staff proof vest, the inserts of my vest out, and stuffed my vest with pouches of tobacco. And I put the vest on, and I put my uniform on over it. So as I'm walking through, nervous and shaking and looking around, because I just knew everybody knew what was going on, and as soon as I walked through this door, they was just going to jump out and get me. And the captain stopped me. At that moment, I was like, holy crap, this is it. He's going to rip open my shirt. And he's going to find out that I have all these cigarettes on me. I froze. He turned me around. He used me as an example to tell the other officers that this is what he liked. He loved when officers came to work dressed and ready to start the day. He told me good work, and he patted me on my back. That was full of tobacco, full of cigarettes, and I walked on through the door into the prison. I didn't get caught that first time. The fear went away, and then the greed set in. Okay, well, first it started with cigarettes, and then eventually it escalated to liquor, cell phones, cocaine, or whatever I thought the inmates thought was of value at the time. I was powerful. I felt I was. I did it for about 6 years. One morning, I got a knock on the door. And they said it was the police. They took me downtown. They placed me in a room. And they told me not to talk. Right then and there, I knew it was over. I knew I was in really deep trouble. Right then and there, I became an inmate. It was devastating. And that very first day when I heard those words that I've uttered over and over to inmates, take everything out your pockets. Take your shirt off. Don't shake it out. Take your socks off. Don't shake it out. The humiliated part of you standing there naked, open your mouth, run your fingers through your mouth. And then your clothes are taken and you're given a bright orange jumpsuit. And just like that, you're incarcerated and you're in the system. I don't cry much, and I hadn't cried in years. And that first night, I broke down. I curled up on that bed and I cried all night, all night. Officers would come up and look at me like, that's him. That's the correction officer. That's a prisoner now. So it was like a creep show. All the things went through my head about, okay, all the people who I had in the line of duty, punched, beat up. I was placed in my cell, and as the way things go, the officers control everything you do, and I needed to use the bathroom, so I caught the attention of an officer walking by my cell, and I asked him, could he give me, you know, some toilet paper? And he looked at me the same way I looked at that inmate at the time, and he said, go wipe your behind with your hand. And that smacked me upside my head. The real karma to me wasn't really, it was partially because of the drugs and the cigarettes and alcohol and stuff that I brought in, but I felt my overall experience in being a correction officer and some of the things that I did, just physically putting your hands on certain individuals for various reasons, to me, I felt absolutely I had deserved to go to prison. You make your bed and you lay in it.
Now, Gary's layover cost him 2 years in prison, but he now has a stable city job, which he does not plan on screwing up. You can find out a whole lot more about Gary, his work, and his book on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. When Snap Judgment returns, karma comes back when you least expect it. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the layover episode, a show about going from point A to point B. In fact, you may be traveling from point A to point B yourself. So we sent our own Nick Vanderkolk out into the field to speak to people who are on the move.
I wake up because I feel something like rubbing on my arm. So I look over and this guy is cuddling up next to me. I think he's knocked out because his eyes were closed. And he's got porn playing on his computer. I'm like, whoa, this is not what I signed up for. I called the flight attendant over and I point to his computer and I was like, can I move? And she gets this really, really sad, apologetic look on her face. She was like, oh, it's a full flight.
I needed to get a ride home from the bus station once I got to Richmond because Richmond doesn't have like super accessible public transportation. And I heard the guy behind me get on the phone and tell his friend that he was gonna drive over when he got back. So I knew he had a car in Richmond. And in DC, I turned around and I said to him, do you think you could give me a ride home? And he said, yeah. And it was, and then we went back to not talking for the whole way to Richmond. And then I don't know why, because we weren't having this incredible conversation, but he asked me if I wanted to come over and watch TV before I went home. So I went to his house and we watched South Park on his bed, and then we fell asleep holding each other, but I had never been held the way that he held me. Like, I remember he squeezed me really tight and just kept whispering in my ear, isn't this weird? Isn't this weird? Isn't this totally unlikely? Isn't this super weird? We didn't even make out. We just held each other. And then in the morning I woke up and I walked home. So I never even got the ride home from him.
Oh, yeah. For our next story, we're jumping across the pond now, going to go to London, England. And Jane was just 22 years old, living at home with her parents, starting out in life at that age where you're trying to shed the identity you had in high school. But, Snap Judgment's Stephanie Fu has a story.
Jane was 22 and sitting in her parents' house when the phone rang.
Out of the blue, I received a phone call from Kevin Whitehead. I hadn't heard from him for about 9 years. When Kevin contacted me and said,
well, I think, you know, we may have known each other.
I was quite taken back by it. I was like, known each other? You broke my heart. We were first going out when we were teenagers, when we were sort of 14, 13. We'd gone out for a summer. I guess he was my first real boyfriend. Kevin was, he was a very cheeky lad and full of confidence. I think that's why I liked him, because he was sort of Jack the lad. Towards the end of the summer break, before we were going back to school, Kevin dumped me over the phone, quite cruelly, really. I was heartbroken.
So Jane was understandably suspicious when he called her 9 years later.
He said that he'd had quite a serious motorbike accident. As a result of the accident, he had memory loss. His memory was like a jigsaw puzzle. Going back to his childhood days, there were gaps in his past that he didn't recall. Part of his rehab was contacting people from his past. They suggested that, you know, contacting people may help put those jigsaw pieces together.
And so, while looking up old friends on a social network, Kevin stumbled across Jane's profile.
Then I sort of saw Jane Peart, and I was like, I remember her. She was a friend. Yeah, she was a friend. And then when I was looking through my old diaries and my school days and stuff, trying to just help me with memories, and I sort of come across Jane's number.
But it was a strange situation to be in, to have to remind someone of the fact that he dumped me. I couldn't actually picture the Kevin that I knew before with the Kevin that I was speaking to on the phone. It was like talking to a stranger.
What Jane didn't realize was that Kevin really was a stranger at this point, even to himself. Before, Kevin had been all motorcycles and bar fights.
I used to be an arrogant person. One of the things my dad said, like, you need to like sort yourself out because you're turning into a nasty person, you know. But then after the accident, that changed me.
Now he was quiet, shy, prone to anxiety attacks. It really struck Jane when she met up with him for the first time at his house.
When I turned up and he'd opened the front door and came out to the car, it was a bit strange because it was completely a different person in terms of the way he looked. Filled out a little bit, although I'm not sure he would like me saying that.
I was sitting there talking to Jane, and she was talking. I weren't doing that much talking because I was in no sort of fit state to sort of keeping up conversation or anything, you know. I'm sort of having panic attacks left, right and centre.
I could see that the guy that was sitting in front of me was a guy that really had lost his world. I could see the pain in his face.
Kevin told Jane that it was a huge comfort to be able to talk to someone from his school days, because a lot of that time was a blank for him. And his other childhood friends hadn't responded to his emails, just her.
While I've got Jane speaking to me, my brain's doing 3 times the speed, linking up different memories. Just talking, that was bringing back memories of, say, my granddad 25 years ago. All the memories were getting mixed up, but I did start to bring back a lot of memories of sort of me and Jane. The memories that are being brought back from being where we are, once again, doesn't mean that it's good feelings, could be bad feelings.
Like, Kevin finally remembered breaking up with Jane over the phone. And he remembered that years after he broke up with her, even into his late teens, he'd always drive down Jane's street, hoping to catch a glimpse of her.
I never, ever, ever got over Jane. I always liked her. She was very attractive. I liked the way she was. She was sort of a bit like, I was only young, but a bit like my sort of idol girlfriend. I always regretted I sort of dumped her, but I never ever got over her.
unfortunately, Jane had gotten over Kevin years ago. And helping him now?
It wasn't anything to do with a romance. It was like I was the shoulder for Kevin. Something just said to me, if this person's had this accident, regardless of the past, if I'm the only person that can help him, then I felt that I had a duty to do that.
When Jane and Kevin would meet up, they'd often go to places where they and their friends used to hang out. And she'd tell him, oh, this is where we'd go swimming. This is where we met. One day, she was driving by the river and said, oh, this is where we first kissed.
Well, she's taking me back to this kissing part. I was in the car at the end of the night. It was just racking around in my brain. And I'm sort of sitting there and I'm just like, what do I? Do I? Don't I? I've never been good at working out signals and all that anyway at the best of times, let alone when I've got no confidence and everything's all mixed up. Sort of a young, sort of 20-year-old attractive girl, giving her time to spend time with this sort of wreck of a man, you know, this embarrassment, and I'm just there and I'm in the car and I said to Jane, like, well, I know what I want to do. I want to kiss you.
We shared a kiss again for the first time. It was kind of mixed emotions, but it just felt right.
She was everything I wanted. I was sitting there and I'm kissing this girl and I'm like, this is just amazing. It was just amazing. And I remember thinking about that so much that I just sort of stopped kissing her. I was just frozen against her, just like a leech just stuck onto her face. Yeah, enough about that.
I can also remember the other kiss, which was the kiss when we were teenagers. But they were completely different. Much better kisser the second time round.
Well, she didn't complain then, so couldn't have been that bad.
After that, Jane was smitten. Of course, they had their fair share of difficulties as a couple, getting Kevin through his rehabilitation, finding him a job. But Kevin was always so good to her, in a way she never dreamed he could have been.
That's the part that I sort of fell in love with, which was his kindness and the caring side to him that I saw when we met and thereafter. I can't thank him enough for some of the things that he had done.
So I found that through Jane, she made me a lot nicer person. Jane's sort of niceness sort of wearing off on me, and I've turned into a much nicer person. I do fully understand that. After everything I've gone through, I'm now with that girl who I loved, wanted to be with, you know, and she's still with me and she's still beautiful and she's still everything to me.
Jane and Kevin Whitehead are now married and have two beautiful young twins. They live in London. And big thanks to both of them. And be sure to check out Kevin's book, A Happy Accident, Fate Not Fatal. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Stephanie Fu. Now then, it's about that time. It is. But don't fret. Don't frown, Snap Nation. The Snap can't be contained in a single hour anyway. No, get you to the podcast. Full episodes, movies, pictures, stuff. Waiting for you right now at snapjudgment.org. Facebook, yes, we're on the Facebook. Twitter, yes, snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by myself and the most capable, trustworthy, danceable crew flying these friendly skies. Please put your hands together for the air marshal himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Bassini-Miller ensures that you have just enough beats in your landing and never a beat too many. Stephanie Fu is afraid of flying. Anna Sussman is afraid of peanuts. Julie DeWitt is afraid of nothing at all. Nick Vanderkolk would rather take the bus. Renzo Gorio, he'd rather take the train. And Will Urbina, he'd rather not go if it's all the same to you. Now, did you ever fly first class executive seating on a coast-to-coast airplane with the champagne and caviar sampler? No? Well, me neither. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting would not stand for it. Back in coach, baby. Love it. We love it. And much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, puts the public where its mouth is.
I don't even know what that means. They put their mouth on the public? PRX.org. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could hang out down at the bus station, carry around a big suitcase, complain loudly about the trials and tribulations of cross-country bus travel. And when they finally say, all aboard, you could go back to your apartment, call your friends, and tell them the two-hour story of how you almost went somewhere. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.